For Judaism, a Jewish leader that is victorious in battle but has no love for the Jewish people is not a truly great statesman. Conversely, a ruler who sustains the continuity of Israel, who strengthens its families and ensures the education of the next generation, produces achievements more remarkable than the expansion of any empire. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 53. God bless the Queen, the greatest ruler of Second Temple Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It is a striking fact that during the First Temple period, there was only a few rulers of Jerusalem whose reign can be seen as entirely successful. But it is even more striking and less well known that in the Second Temple period, there was only one ruler of Jerusalem that was both royal and righteous. And this was not a king at all, but rather a queen, the only queen regnant in Jewish history. We described yesterday how the widow of King Aristobulus, Queen Salome Alexandra, or Shlom Tzion, married her brother-in-law Alexander Yanai, and how this king brutally butchered the masses. But throughout this terrible time, the king's admiration for his righteous wife endured, thereby setting the stage for what was to come, years seen by the rabbis as one of the truly golden periods in Jerusalem's history. It is this story that we tell today, as I draw on and expand upon my lecture about Queen Shlom Tzion that I delivered in my Tikva Jewish Statesmanship series. After a reign of 20 years, King Alexander Yanai fell ill, and on his deathbed, though he had two sons from Shlom Tzion, the king did the unthinkable and insisted that his wife would be his heir and rule in his stead, thereby creating the only true queen regnant in the history of Jewish Jerusalem. After a reign of 20 years, Yanai fell ill, and on his deathbed, though he had two sons from Shlom Tzion, the king unexpectedly insisted that his wife would be his heir and rule in his stead. But the Talmud and Josephus in his Antiquities agree that, though the king was loyal to the Sadducees, he advised his queen to seek out their rivals, the Pharisees, embrace them, and bring the civil war to a close. Josephus writes as follows, quote, "But when his queen saw that he was ready to die and had no longer any hopes of surviving, she came to him weeping and lamenting, and bewailed herself and her sons on the desolate condition that they should be left in, and said to him, 'To whom dost thou leave me and my children, who are destitute of all other supports? And this when thou knowest how much ill will thy nation bears thee.' But he gave her the following advice, that she need but follow what he would suggest to her in order to retain the kingdom securely with her children, that she should conceal his death from the soldiers till she should have taken that place, that after this she should go in triumph as upon a victory to Jerusalem, and put some of her authority into the hands of the Pharisees, for that they would commend her for the honor she had done them, and would reconcile the nation to her. For he told her, they had great authority among the Jews, both to do hurt to such as they hated, and to bring advantages to those to whom they were friendly disposed. For that they are then believed best of all by the multitude, when they speak any severe thing against others, though it be only out of envy at them. And he said that it was by their means that he had incurred the displeasure of the nation, whom indeed he had injured. Do thou therefore, said he, when thou art come to Jerusalem, send for the leading men among them, and show them my body, and with great appearance of sincerity, give them leave to use it as they themselves please, whether they will dishonor the dead body by refusing it burial, as having severely suffered by my means, or whether in their anger they will offer any other injury to that body." End quote. Josephus has a negative attitude toward the Pharisees, which of course is not my approach. But from this story, we learn that Yanai was willing for the queen to give over his body to his enemies in order that his beloved wife could attain the throne. This reflects the extraordinary charisma that this queen must have had. And we must add that there is one single sentence in Josephus' other work, The Jewish War, that is extraordinary, for it hints to us the queen's political posture during this entire period. Josephus writes, quote, "Now Alexander left the kingdom to Alexandra his wife, and depended upon it that the Jews would now very readily submit to her, because she had been very averse to such cruelty as he had treated them with, and had opposed his violation of their laws, and had thereby got the goodwill of the people," end quote. What this means is that throughout the king's brutal assault on his subjects, the queen, Alexandra, or Shlom Tzion, had somehow publicly opposed her husband. It is therefore not too much to say that under assault by their king, the Jews of Judea were sustained by the support of their queen. What's left unexplained is how she was able to survive in a family known for murdering all those that opposed its kings. What emotional hold did she have on Yanai, so that he not only never threatened her life, but held her in such esteem that he handed her the throne? This testifies, at the very least, to a remarkable personality reflected by this regal personage. Josephus, who, as we mentioned, did not adore the Pharisees, nevertheless describes Shlomtzion's profound connection to the people. The king, he writes, quote, was not mistaken as to his expectations, for this woman kept the dominion by the opinion that the people had of her piety, for she chiefly studied the ancient customs of her country and cast those men out of the government that offended against their holy laws, end quote. This is the rise to power of Shlomtzion, beloved Pharisee queen. She is little known outside Talmudic tradition, but among rabbinic Jews, she is celebrated because of her love for the people and their love for her. She was, for the Talmud, the one monarch of the Second Temple period who truly embodied what monarchy was supposed to mean, a bond between king and people. But in an age ruled by brutal men, it was, for the rabbis, a woman who revealed true royalty. With the crowning of Shlomtzion, the Pharisees sought punishment of those who had engineered Yanai's cruel crucifixions, but otherwise the civil war came to a close. And under Shlomtzion's rule, the Sanhedrin, the supreme Jewish religious court known then as the Grusia, expelled its Sadducees, and the sage Shimon ben Shetach was placed firmly in control of the body. In a Pharisaic administration dedicated to and supported by the larger population, two enormously important enactments were pronounced that reverberate in rabbinic Judaism to this day. The first was the institution of the marital document known as the Ketubah. The Ketubah today is often seen as a mystical romantic document, in part because it is written in Aramaic, a language less known now than Hebrew, so that when it's read aloud at the chuppah, it sounds akin to an incantation or a spell from Harry Potter. Vana eflach va'oker va'farnes yisichi lichi. But the Ketubah is mundane. It is written in Aramaic because that, not Hebrew, was the vernacular of the masses in Second Temple of Judea. And the Ketubah is a document meant for the masses, and therein lies its magnificence. It was created as a prenuptial agreement in order to protect women, and especially poor women, safeguarding their marriages and their status after marriage. Previously, before this time, a man could divorce his wife and leave her with nothing. And if a husband died, it was his children, not the wife, who would inherit. But from the age of Shlomtzion and Shimon ben Shetach onward, the Ketubah obligated the husband to support his wife during the marriage and entitled the wife to payment if the marriage disintegrated. We can readily understand how the peril of penury originally afflicted especially the women of the poorer classes. So can it be a coincidence that the concept of ketubah, affected in protection of women, especially of poor women, emerged precisely at the one moment in Jewish history when Israel was ruled by a woman who was allied with the Sanhedrin, a Sanhedrin ruled by Pharisees who, like the Queen of Judea, was so deeply attuned to the needs of the larger populace. Thus, family, marriage, perpetuation was strengthened under Shlomtzion's reign. The second Pharisaic institution formed at this moment was universal education, the establishment, according to the Talmud, of a network of schools, ensuring learning is an obligation for members of all social strata at a very young age. Thus was it ensured that education was no longer for the elite, another testament, perhaps, to Shlomtzion's loyalty to and her love for the general populace. The rabbis refer to this tranquil time of religious revival in Jerusalem as the era of Shlomtzion and Shimon ben Shetach, giving credit for its achievements not only to the religious leaders, but to the queen for this domestic tranquility and growth. Interestingly, Josephus, who was not a Pharisee and did not love this queen, nevertheless further informs us of Shlomtzion's military success. He is more excited about her foreign rather than her domestic accomplishments. Josephus writes, quote, "She was a sagacious woman in the management of great affairs and intent always upon gathering soldiers together, so that she increased the army the one half and procured a great body of foreign troops, till her own nation became not only very powerful at home, but terrible also to foreign potentates," end quote. That the rabbis do not speak of her military campaigns reflects the fact that for them, it was not only her political success, but also, indeed first and foremost, her spiritual and moral righteousness that set her apart as the greatest royal ruler of Second Temple Jerusalem. In Talmudic tales, Queen Shlomtzion is described as the sister of the head of the Sanhedrin. And while this may indeed be a literal statement, the constant emphasis of this familial connection by the Talmud in its stories is also, I think, an allusion to a verse in Proverbs about wisdom, about the Torah, a verse that describes how the Pharisees saw this great queen. Emor lechochma achoti at, say unto wisdom, you are my sister. For the rabbis, Queen Shlomtzion embodied the spirit of the Torah. She embodied wisdom itself. She was the ultimate woman of valor. For Judaism, a Jewish leader that is victorious in battle but has no love for the Jewish people is not a truly great statesman. Conversely, a ruler who sustains the continuity of Israel, who strengthens its families and ensures the education of the next generation, produces achievements more remarkable than the expansion of any empire. No empire lasts, but perpetuation and education are eternal. And what was accomplished during this period for Jewish family and Jewish transmission was a result of the love for the people personified by Queen Shlomtzion. Of course, the cynic could easily ask, don't the rabbis remember Shlomtzion with love because she was on their side? After all, Churchill famously commented that history will be kind to me for I intend to write it. And in the end, Shlomtzion is recalled with reverence because it was the ears to the Pharisees through whom Judaism continued. Thus, one could cynically remark that of course the rabbis are going to love a woman who adheres to rabbinic Judaism. Of course they're going to admire a ruler who, as it were, placed the rabbis in charge. But to make such a charge is to reference a much more interesting question. It is true, of course, that Pharisaic Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, reveres a queen that was its ally. But why was it only Pharisaic Judaism that survived? Why are there no Sadducees today? Here the answer again, as I argued in my statesmanship lecture series, can be found in what took place under Shlomtzion's reign. As many note, following the fall of Jerusalem in the year 70 CE, the Sadducees, whose elitist circle was centered on the temple and the privileges of the priesthood, had no source of sustaining its own identity, and they soon disappeared from the historical scene. Meanwhile, Pharisaic Jews, especially in Shlomtzion's reign, had created a culture that focused on family and education of the populace, and therefore it endured. Rabbinic Judaism triumphed as Judaism because the institutions of family and learning that emerged in Shlomtzion's era allowed for the form of Judaism in which she believed to survive forever. The Hasmonean dynasty ceased to rule soon after Shlomtzion, and, as we will see, Rome then followed, bringing about the brutal reign of the Second Temple's most famous king, Herod. Herod, as we will see, will become known as the great builder throughout Judea. But in the end, it was precisely what was built during Shlomtzion's reign that the Romans would never succeed in destroying. For as Daniel Webster once said, if we work on marble, it will perish. If we work on brass, time will efface it. If we rear temples, they will crumble to dust. But if we work on men's immortal minds, we engrave on those tablets something which time cannot efface and which will brighten and brighten to all eternity. This is why we continue to love and revere this queen's memory. If David is the king of Jerusalem forever, Shlomtzion is its queen, and we, the Jewish people, are forever in her debt. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.